Welcome to Finding Joy with Kara. I am your host, Kara Kavensky. Today, my guest is Phoenix Jackson. She is the CEO and founder of The Phoenix Effect. Their tagline is influence something. And their mission is to shine more focused light on already bright individuals. Today, Phoenix and I explore plenty of opportunities for change, specifically encompassing systemic racism in a variety of different verticals, especially the medical field. This is a deeply personal conversation for Phoenix, and one that she speaks to with an amazing amount of candor and honesty. I'm so thrilled to be able to speak with you today, and I get the privilege of being able to see you. I'm so sorry that my listeners can't, but they could see you if they watched your TEDx talk, which is just delightful. And Phoenix, you are the Chief Communications Officer for the Phoenix Effect, which is a global communications company that you founded 16 years ago. And can you please tell me a little bit about the type of people that you work with, because you've got a pretty extensive list of clientele, and and what you do for your clients?
Yes. Thank you, Kara. And thank you for having me. For all you guys who know Kara and those who don't, she is an awesome spirit, such a connector, so brilliant and multifaceted. And we speak the same language. So thank you, Kara, for having me. Like she said, I'm Phoenix Jackson, and I'm the Chief Communications Officer of the Phoenix Effect. But yes, we are a global PR and marketing firm, and we've worked with everyone from celebrities to politicians to professional athletes to global nonprofits to all the way to like smaller mom and pop shops and personal brands who need a leg up in becoming their vision. Our tagline is influence something. So we're pushing the envelope and focused on pushing the collective forward and making sure that the projects we work on, the people we work with, are all doing their role and their part globally or nationally or locally in their communities with pushing the human collective forward. And we do everything from the media relations to digging people out of holes when they need to publicly. Fun part.
Gotta love the crisis communications.
Yes, yes. To like helping manage their launches. Let's say they have a book that they've come out with, or they are launching some new program or initiative with their nonprofit. We assist with everything from audience expectations to even helping with just various focus groups and kind of seeing like, what does the public want? Are they asking for this? Do they need this? And just all of those type of things. And it has been 16 years running, which seems like such a long time, but not, because time is moving extremely fast. And I can honestly say that I really do like what
you're super good at what you do. So you have to love it. Those two things go hand in hand most of the time, if people are really lucky. And you also wear a couple other hats, and you do some really meaningful work with two organizations in particular. And I'd love for you to explain just briefly what those are.
Yes. So I also handle the chief communications for two financial tech firms that are pushing, again, like go down to that same flow of like pushing the human collective forward. These both are trying to create equity for people of color and women as well. So most people are not aware of this, but if you are a single woman or a person of color, particularly a Black or a Latino person, you're guaranteed to pay higher interest rates, higher fees for getting a home loan if they approve you at all. Right now, even in Mississippi, I think it was on NPR that they stated that a Black family making $150,000 a year have a harder time at getting a loan approval of a white family making $30,000 a year. And this shows itself all over the country in various ways. And our company, Acroma Mortgage, is actually the first blind lending platform that makes it to where it does not take your gender, does not take your race, does not take any identifying factors for you. You are judged based on purely your financial data and your ability to pay back a home loan, which is what the average white male is judged on. A single woman as well gets charged higher fees. I don't know if I actually just mentioned that. And so we created Acroma, A-C-H-R-O-M-A, to mitigate this issue directly. And I'm also, like I said, there's two companies. The second one is sort of the precursor to Acroma. It's called Rental Karma. We are helping people put their rental history and their current rent payments onto their credit report. And it boosts their score an average of 40 points, which is really exciting. Yeah. And that sometimes gets people over that threshold that they need to qualify for a better home loan, to, you know, qualify for that newer car, to have a better, you know, interest rate as it pertains to their credit cards. And so when my partner created this company, and we talked about this company 8 years ago, and he recently brought me on to help with this second phase of launch, bringing in the great investors, like all of this stuff, I was like, yes, I'm going to come in here, and Phoenix Effect is going to do its duty right now to push both of these companies forward, because they are definitely helping to level the playing field and to provide equity for women and people of color.
So rent payments were not included at all towards a credit report, correct?
Right.
Okay.
They would consider, of course, your credit card payments, your car payment, but our home payments are the biggest bill for renters, and mortgage as well. It's usually about 30% of their bill. In some places, it's 50%. Their rent is 50% of their monthly income. And so I feel like that should be counted for. People should get some credit for those on-time rent payments.
Well, those are two really important fintech, you know, financial technology or finance technology companies that can really move the needle for a lot of people. And during the last year, fortunately, conversations are coming up with solutions, not just to talk about it, but solutions are being proposed. And I love these two companies that you're engaging in. So
Thank you.
I will include those links, like the information on those companies, in the show notes for sure.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. I think we have a difficult conversation coming up. When you and I first connected, you shared a story with me that I thought we need to discuss this and record it. And the pandemic has brought a lot of challenges and in isolation, but it hasn't changed a lot of medical care, as far as I think maybe systemic racism in the medical vertical.
Yes.
Has been more obvious.
Pronounced.
The pandemic has shined a spotlight on a lot of warts in our society, and the access to healthcare without bias is something that not many people of color experience, meaning that you are an African American woman, I am a white woman, we both go to the hospital at the same time, you and I may be treated differently, period.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And this is horrible. Education is part of it. So I would love for you to share your experience in the last year and how that's impacted you.
Yes, yes. And so you are totally correct about the difference in treatment for, you know, people of color as it pertains to the medical field. I mean, right now in Alabama, they are having a vaccine rollout. And one of the Jefferson County commissioners, Sheila Tyson, just spoke about how in one county, they have zero vaccines that have been given to that Black poor county, like zero vaccines. And of course, if you go to the white affluent suburb in Birmingham, totally different story. And they don't have a response of why they just haven't given Black folks any vaccines in that particular county, other than saying, well, there's hesitancy amongst the Black community, but she's saying we have over 125,000 people of color who have basically in through polls have said, yes, we will take the vaccine. So their answer does not fit the reality. But there is, of course, a disparity in care. You are very aware of this for Black mothers and babies in America, with the infant mortality rate, both in utero and before they complete their first year of life. And I was a victim of that here as well. And I actually don't mind sharing the hospital and the information, but I had a midwifery team at Swedish Hospital here in Denver, Colorado. And, you know, it was during the pandemic. So I gave them a lot of leeway as far as, like, you know, one time we had a digital medical session that, of course, their systems didn't work. We never actually had the digital part of the session. Things didn't quite work with the technology. And the next time I had an appointment for my glucose testing, I actually let my midwife nurse know at that session, that at that appointment, that, hey, the baby is a bit erratic. I feel, that was the word I used. I was like, I feel something different about his energy. He was moving and scrambling more than usual. And he was already an active little guy. Mind you, I was 7 months pregnant. He was already an active little guy. And I knew his movements, knew how often he was always going. And it was like, that was like doubled. And she just was like, oh, it's okay. It's probably just, you know, the sugar, the glucose in the system. It's nothing. And he died 4 days later. And that type of response to Black mothers is very common. And on average, our babies die four times as much as white women babies, which is so detrimental. I don't want any woman, I don't care what race, I don't want any woman's children to pass. But our children are, for whatever reason, dying faster. And I know there are certain social determinants of health related to the stress that the average Black person undertakes in America. You know, you're stressed about if a cop's going to kill you. You're stressed about if you have a teenage son like myself. I constantly think when he leaves the house, is he going to come back? And I'm not worried about another Black person killing him. I'm worried about a racist white person or a cop killing him. And there's just things like that they say are definitely social determinants of health that cause stress. But one thing that we shouldn't worry about is, we already worry about, you know, not being protected by our justice system, but we also shouldn't worry about not getting the proper care that we need to make sure that our children are transitioned into this world properly. I'm literally right now in discussions with my law team to talk about this. And I'm in discussions with a whole nother hospital who ironically came to me recently and said, hey, we know that your PR firm, your communications firm, does a very good job at translating and communicating very tough topics and subjects to the public. We want to tackle infant mortality in the Black community in Colorado. And I said, oh, well, yes, I'm very interested in this project, but also this just happened to me. Oh, they had no idea. I've spoken about the baby passing, but I have not spoken publicly about the house, because I'm actually, you know, just, I've actually saved it. Like, I'm going to save that story for when it's time to enlighten and educate the right people who can definitely do something about this issue. And so the largest children's hospital in Colorado, they can do something about this issue. So of course, working with them hand in hand makes a difference. And the hospital that I was at, they barely took care of me even after the fact. I had to go to a Black midwifery group in Houston, Texas, to have them consult with me on ways to heal my body, ways to help heal things emotionally, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of women, especially under the age of 30, Black women who go through this tragedy and their baby ends up dying or end up having a stillbirth, or their baby's born and there's something wrong and they don't get the proper care, or the doctor's like, oh, it's nothing. And then their baby dies and they don't have the tools and the support to properly guide them through the healing process. And that's tough, because that's the hardest part, is the healing, of course.
Well, it's devastating. And only recently can we look at women who are coming forward, talking about mm-hmm. even miscarriages much earlier, you know, in pregnancy, let alone a case like yours, which is just devastating. I'm so sorry that you went through this.
Yeah, thank you.
The CDC came out a couple of years ago and said that the cause of the 3x to 4x infant maternal mortality rates with African American women is due to racism.
Yeah. So what I know and understand for sure is that doctors, nurses, midwives, all of those of you know, white complexion, they tend to think that we as Black people can hoard a lot of pain. They tend to think that we don't feel the same level of pain that whites do. It's almost like there's a superhuman complex and it's just not real. Case in point with the opioid crisis, a Black person, and actually this is a real story that I know of someone personally, but a Black person can have a knee surgery and are given the 800 milligram ibuprofen or Tylenol, whereas a white person having that same surgery is going to be given the hard stuff, the Percocets, the Oxycontin, et cetera, which granted that has backfired, because then you have tens of thousands of people dying a year from the, you know, opioid epidemic. However, we are not treated the same, even in pain management. And we have to go through hell and high water to even receive painkillers, which is interesting. So when a woman says, hey, I'm hurting or this is happening, they are less likely to listen to us because they don't think that our pain levels are the same. A white woman saying, hey, my pain level is a 5, they're going to treat it as if her pain level is a 7. A black woman saying my pain level is a 5, they're going to treat it as if you just said your pain level is a 2. And this spans socioeconomic class. It spans all of that because even, you know, Beyonce and Serena Williams both had issues in the delivery room when they were having their children, and they can afford the best care. Serena Williams stated on her docuseries that she knew she was having a blood clot in her body, and she kept telling them this is exactly what it is, because as a premier athlete, she knows her body more than anybody. Like, you have to be in touch with the intricate parts of your body. And they scrambled and scrambled and scrambled and finally listened to her, which was life-saving. A blood clot could travel to your brain and brain aneurysm, and you could obviously pass away. Well, even when I was giving birth to my son, Cameron, after he passed, so stillbirth, you have to give birth. I gave birth to him. I was having an allergic reaction to the anesthesia because with my first son, who's now 14, I had an all natural water birth. And that's what I was planning to for this experience as well. Of course, it didn't turn out that way. But I kept telling them, like, you know, I'm having an allergic reaction. My body was breaking out in hives. My chest was closing up. My voice got really scrambling. My throat was closing up, and they were not listening. They were like, they were scrambling, the anesthesiologist and the nurse. And my son was asleep next to me in the cot next to me. And I said, wake up, wake up, wake up. And I yelled at him, like, and he hopped up, and I said, I need you to pay attention to everything that's happening. Because in that moment, I was afraid I'm going to die because my body's having this very clear allergic reaction. I can't breathe. Like, my chest is closing up. My partner wasn't there. My father had just left. The only person that was there was my son. Now, my partner came hours later. He had to fly in to get back home, you know, for the birth and everything, because everything was happening so fast. But he came in hours later and he was very furious, you know. But I had to tell my son, you have to wake up. Like, because I, in that moment, I was like, I'm getting ready to die because they are literally not listening to me. Oh, that God. I'm telling him I'm having an allergic reaction. And so I repeated it over and over again. And finally, I said, I need Benadryl. Someone give me Benadryl. Someone, like, right now. And I had to basically get aggressive with them. And then they put some Benadryl into the IV, and boom, within like a minute, it started to just, Benadryl is a magical drug. My body started to relax. But I was like, why did I have to go through all of that for them just to do the simple thing that I asked the first time? And then they ran all these tests. Like, we want to make sure you don't have a blood clot in your lung. And I said, I don't have any of those things. I just was having an allergic reaction. And of course, they ran up the doctor's bill, getting this test, this test, this test. And of course, nothing was wrong. I was just having an allergic reaction, like I stated. Mm-hmm. But I can't imagine a woman who maybe is not as educated, a Black woman who's not as educated as I am, or who does not have the access that I have, who would be in my same situation. Because there's so many Black mothers that die, so many Black babies that die. That's who I'm concerned about. I'm not even concerned about myself anymore because I have a voice. I have the ear of very important people around this country. I'm concerned about the other Black women who do not have that.
The voice. You advocated for yourself. You spoke yes. up. There are so many women that don't do that, that find their voice later, that are dealing with trauma and pain and just found it difficult, where they mm-hmm. are trusting. You want to trust a medical professional. Mm-hmm. You want to believe them, but it's not in all cases. And mm-hmm. and you have to advocate for yourself. And I can't imagine.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a tough thing to swallow that we're still dealing with these issues. America would be so great if we could make use out of the individuals of different, you know, racial, creed, religious backgrounds. Like, we are such a great melting pot. We would be phenomenal. And America just does not make use out of the people the way that it should. And it's why it's failing. America's failing because of that very issue. Like, if you're blessed with, you know, a business that has people of different races, socioeconomic backgrounds, all these different things who are at the table, you're blessed with the diversity of information. You're blessed with a way to connect with and make money from and educate everyone, you know, but America does not take advantage of that, unfortunately.
We have so many established systems. You know, you look at medical mm-hmm. school just by itself, and who wrote all the books, and who created the curriculum, and who's doing the dominant part of the teaching, even if there is a diverse staff. What are they teaching, and where did that educational curriculum originate? And it's perpetuating forward. Mm-hmm. And the same goes in schools where we're teaching certain things, and maybe it's even different around the country. Textbooks yes. are not the same. You know, we're whitewashing, we're rewriting history, we're leaving out key components. We're not acknowledging who actually built the Capitol building, which labor force was responsible for and taken advantage of to build right. our nation, and what we have done to the Native Americans, the original Americans.
Yes, yes.
And dishonoring, that's a whole thing. But when rules and regulations apply where someone's not being heard or seen, where an individual mm-hmm. thinks they know more about your body than you do.
Yeah.
That's a problem. That's a right. big problem.
Right. And it's definitely something that hopefully we'll be able to provide more awareness about, and we're able to provide some policy change. Like, there's a law change in California about this very issue for doctors to listen to Black women, a bill passed. But it's like, why do you have to pass a law for them to do their ethical job? Just doesn't make sense, you know?
Right. Apparently, we need to be very, very specific in this, and it should be part of our inherent value system in our country, yes. and it's not.
I mean, when you have in 2021, statistically, where farmers, white farmers have access to loans and all types of things to kind of get them a leg up, and not literally no loans have gone out to Black or Latino farmers, zero. That's crazy to me. That's crazy.
There's so much opportunity for change. There's yes. so much opportunity for change to positively spin it.
Yes.
There's opportunity everywhere. I just can't imagine anyone denying the existence of systemic racism. And
right. Well, people deny it all the time.
It's insane.
There's Gen Zers who are literally getting bred to think that, you know, redlining never existed and this never happened. No, there's equality. You have LeBron James and you have Oprah. And it's like, they don't understand that. Yes, big corporations use Black faces to sell everything. If you look around from the Hulu commercials to the billboards, they have Black skin on everything because to be Black is cool, right? People want to be Black, but they don't want to be Black. And they want to look like us, but they don't want to actually be us. And so corporations use our faces to sell everything. But that does not mean that they care about the average everyday person. They don't see LeBron and Oprah as Black. Mm-hmm. They see Oprah as a mother. She's a stereotypical mother figure of which back in slavery, they had Black mothers, heavyset Black women who raise the children. Oprah is that archetype. And I know she's aware of it because I've heard her say on stage. The last time I met her, I heard her actually say on stage, "Welcome my children," in front of 15,000 predominantly white women. "Welcome my children. You guys have been my children." All da, da, da. And I was like, she just said that. And I was like, she's aware of her archetype. She's has to be aware of her archetype. Mm-hmm. And of course, the big, strong Buck athlete is the same archetype as the big, strong Buck slave who they nuke would always be loyal. He's going to make some more strong Black babies. And it's the same archetypes. It just shows up differently. And well, no one talks about that either, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah.
Well, and then we look at the female athletes and women who like say track and field, and they have these contracts with Nike and other athletic brands that, you know, there's several, but then mm-hmm. they want to have a baby, and then they are risking being dropped and yes. assumed that they're not going to be as fast or not going to be able to come back or their career is ending because they chose right. to be a mom.
Right. And women deal with that, you know, and there's one thing about people of color, but women as well. Women have dealt with, I mean, we're in, you know, International Women, or we're in Women's Month, Women History Month, but women as well have dealt with so much disparity too. Like I said, down, and we started with this, down to a single woman of any race will have a higher interest rate and all that, because they know that women are not going to shop around for mortgages. Mm-hmm. And a woman will end up paying more, tens of thousands of dollars more in interest over the life of her loan than a man will. But women are statistically more than likely to actually pay off a mortgage. It just doesn't make sense. Like, why make it harder for women, but you guys already pay men more?
Well, it's not that long ago, just a few decades, that women could even get a loan on their own without a man co-signing.
Which is, yeah.
I mean, that's just insane.
Yes. Like
in my lifetime. In my
right,
lifetime.
Right, I was going to say, yeah.
That
yeah,
happened.
Yeah.
That happened.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And women are women know how to pinch a penny. Like every mother that I know, whether they're married or single or divorced like myself, they know how to pinch a penny. Well, we know how to make things stretch. We know how to make things work. And we know how to multitask and handle multiple things at once. And it's like, why make us pay more? And in America, Black and Latino families pay $500 million more in interest than white families. Which is insane, because it's like, well, we only have a fraction of the loans. We only have a fraction of the loans. So how are we paying astronomically more money than whites? It's deep and it's interesting. Going back to what we were talking about, I had the hospital that I lost my son Cameron at. They reached out to me with a letter and said, well, we would love to, after I basically reached out to them and told them like, hey, these are the things you guys did wrong. And we're going to address this in the future. And I want you all to be aware that I'm speaking with a law group, because you guys basically make the wrong mistakes with the wrong person. And not in a threatening way, but just a very clear letter of these are the steps we're getting ready to take. And they responded, and we're apologizing that you felt this way or felt that way. We would love to help you with your family planning, like you and your partner's family planning for the future, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, no. Why would I ever come back to you all after what just happened? Like there's no trust there. I could just say this to you, Kara. I can't even walk into that building without feeling very emotional and very triggered. Yes. And so I told them, oh, definitely not. I'm like, you guys didn't even take care of me postmortem. So of course I'm not going to come back. And I only went to this particular midwifery and OBGYN group because I had my son at midwifery and OBGYN at the same hospital 14 years previous, but that was a full authentic midwifery group, meaning they had the water births, they chemical and anesthesia free. The midwife was phenomenal. She was a white woman, and then her partner midwife was a Black woman, and they took phenomenal care of me. But she was a white woman who was like 5'11", Amazonian, who had 5 children. Naturally, which to me, that like, she's a beast. I'm like, you better go. I'm not going to say her name on air. She's phenomenal. And she had delivered so many babies of all races. And she had this level of compassion and strength. And that I don't even know what to label her as, but she just had this powerful strength that she just knew. She had a holistic way of doing everything. But they closed down her clinic and she ended up moving somewhere else. She's not even practicing in the way that she was practicing before. She's doing more educating. And so, but I was like, well, it's the same hospital group. So maybe it's going to be the same. It was totally different.
I had a home birth with one of my kids. And I had gone to a midwifery clinic with my first, and it didn't, you know, work out. But I love doulas. I love midwives. And there's an effort in Indiana and hopefully around the country to provide doulas to women of color,
yes,
to assist them in empowering them through the birth process and being their advocate for them to help curb the infant maternal mortality rate.
Yes.
And that is one of the processes that is in place to help underserved women to find their voice. And I'm really proud to have worked with some of the storytelling with that organization and that effort.
Thank you for your work.
And there just needs to be so much more. And it's, we need so many more women engaging in that that archetype, quite frankly, to step in, because every doula that I met that was engaged with that process, it was a mission for them, and they fit that. They were like, "Mom is here. I'm here to help you," and are just so loving, so strong, so empowering. They're wonderful listeners. They're compassionate, and they're no BS. So
you need that.
And I need to compliment you on your response to that hospital, because my reaction would have been far less filtered, just to say.
Right.
Far less filtered.
Oh, I plan to get them in other ways. So I'm a very strategic person, and they're going to pay for it without me having to be, you know, aggressive about it. They're going to pay for it, because I'm going to push and make sure that they, and with accountability, make sure that they implement policy, plans, strategy. They're going to spend some money putting together plans and strategy to fix this problem. And not just for me, but for any woman of color that comes after me.
Exactly.
And so it's like, I don't want to hear anything you have to say. This is change. And we're going to hold them, hold their feet to the fire to ensure that they do.
Excellent.
But yeah. Yes.
Well, I think that would be the best outcome given circumstances and what led to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
The best way to honor your son.
Yes. Yes. And that's what it's about. And I want to just, like I said, it's not even about me anymore, because I have the resources to continue to self-care, take breaks, what I need to do to continue to nurture myself through my own grieving process. There's so many women who do not have that, like, at all, you know? Well,
and I hope that those that listen to this, I know that there are organizations out there doing this, fighting the good fight. Mm-hmm. And people are, it's not enough just to know about it. We need to do something, each of us, with supporting the programming that needs to happen to change the culture.
Right.
And eradicate those foundational layers that led to not honoring and listening to someone, regardless of race, regardless of color. Like, look at that intelligent being who knows their body better than anyone.
Yes.
And just listen to them and not dismiss, not disrespect. And it's so sad that it happens on a regular basis.
Right. Right. And that's the problem, that I feel like if someone baby has to pass away, I feel like I would be more understanding if there's some major genetic issue or something that is truly wrong, but a perfectly healthy child should not pass away because of negligence, when you could have easily probably checked the heart rate and be like, oh my God, this baby's struggling. And he was, the umbilical cord was wrapped around his neck. The umbilical cord was twisted at the base, so he was not getting oxygen and blood supply. He was not getting, and he was expressing that.
Oh dear.
And they didn't even check something as simple as checking his heart rate. So when you think about how something simple could change a life, that's when it becomes even more devastating. Unfortunately, I can understand if a child has like spina bifida or just something that is so hindering to where that child would have a tough time surviving without major surgeries and things. I can almost understand if that child's spirit says, you know what, I'm going to back out of this. I don't know if I can deal with this, you know. But like I said, a perfectly healthy child, I feel like that's inexcusable. And I don't want any child to pass, but I feel like I would have been able to handle it better if my child had a major issue.
And I want to talk about your voice for a second. Phoenix, do you remember a time when you weren't this strong? You are a very strong woman. You are superb at vocalizing. Was there a time you weren't like that? Do you remember?
No.
Okay. I didn't think so.
No, I had, while you're asking that, I had to think about it. No, I've always been a clear communicator. I've always known what I needed to do, wanted to do, even as a small child, and I just did it. And then when someone asked me about something, I was just always a clear communicator. Like, I remember as a kid, I was probably, 11 maybe. And I remember telling my aunt about someone that I knew. I was like, I love that person, but I don't like them. I don't like that person very much. And as an adult, I still feel that way about that same person, oddly. I thought about that the other day, and I was like, that's a very clear communicator as a kid, a preteen, to say, I love this person, but I don't like this person. Because some adults don't know how to delineate between love and like, and what that actually means. Communication is my strongest strength. It's my number one strength. I did a test that said communication was my strongest strength when I was an adjunct professor at the University of Denver. But communication definitely is the strong point. And that's never changed. I was that kid where my teacher was like, she's talking in class.
But you had good points to make. I think she should have been listening.
Yeah. It's interesting. I look at my teenage son who was right there when the baby was born, and he, you know, cried, and then he got through it. And then, you know, he'll come and hug me when I have rough days. It's like, he can tell. I think he knows me more than everybody. But he said to me a month or so after the baby passed, he said, I asked him about how he was feeling, you know, what are you going through? And he said, well, I'm fine. He said, I hurt when I think about the fact that baby Cameron won't be able to grow up and have a life. He said, but I'm more concerned about you because this happened to you. It affects me, but it happened to you. And I just thought that was so beautiful. And it just brings back to your question. I think, like, he has that same strength. He's actually not as assertive as I was, but he's very clear communicator. Like, he'll be like, X, Y, Z.
Well, the net does not fall far from the tree.
Yeah. And he can communicate emotionally, and it makes sense as a young man. And I think that's awesome, because I think I wish more men, just men in general in our society, would have been taught to communicate.
Yeah.
Because women are natural communicators. Like, we just got it naturally. Like, what you're doing, Kara, this comes so natural to you, you know?
So. Well, I am so grateful you're able to share the story.
Thank you.
I'm so impressed with your ability to communicate this very difficult situation that happened less than a year ago.
Yes. Thank you.
And I know that you'll continue to heal from this. And I'm really grateful that you've been able to channel a lot of this into very positive, assertive action to make change that is so needed, and hopefully something that can be replicated all around.
Yes. And that's the thing. It's about, you know, affecting systems, right? We have to affect systems. And that's what time it is. Like, America is going to fail, and it's going to continue to chew itself up from the inside out unless we change the systems that are here, even financially, like everything, you know. It's a daunting work, but I'm actually excited in my heart to be a participant in it.
Well, there could not be a better person at the helm creating this change. And I'm really grateful to know you, and I will help you in any way that I can.
Thank you so much, Kara. And I appreciate that so much. And thank you for spending the time to have me on. And I just appreciate you so much. And for all the work that you've done as well with the doulas and Indiana and everything.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this important episode of Finding Joy with Kara. Near the end of the TEDx talk that Phoenix Jackson gave a couple years ago, she asked the audience to stand and place a hand over their heart and say a quick pledge of allegiance to themselves. I pledge allegiance to stop the distractions of my life, to listen to myself, my true inner wants, my desires, my needs, and what it is that will fulfill me. I vow to trust myself and to trust the journey. This resonates now more than ever in her life, and I hope this helps you along your journey to finding joy.